This is the You Can Learn Chinese podcast, part of the Seneca Network from the China Project. For everyone who's trying to learn Chinese or reaching for the next level, you came to the right place. I'm your host, Jared Turner, co-founder of the Mandarin Companion Graded Reader Series, and I rather like the name Saturn. It has a certain ring about it. My co-host is John Passon, co-founder of Mandarin Companion, founder of All Set Learning, the Chinese Grammar Wiki, Sinospice.com, and he childproofed his house, but somehow they still get in. In this episode, John and I are going to talk about some of the most impactful stories of extensive reading on language learning gains, and they're all from published studies. So how good is extensive reading really? Listen to find out. Guest interviews with Sarah Reinstein, a game developer and collector of life experiences. Let's get to it. Hey guys, this is Jared Turner joining you from the United States here in Utah.
Hi everybody, my name is John Pasden. I am based in Shanghai, China. Still, how's it going?
John, I think to start off this episode, I want to recount a little bit of how this whole Mandarin Companion thing started.
Oh, you love telling the story, don't you?
I haven't told it for a while, so you know, maybe we're due.
Okay, any particular angle you're going for here?
You bet. So I'm going to rewind about, I think it was 2011. I was working in some English language education. I was interviewing different teachers for a project they were doing. These are English teachers in Shanghai. And when I interviewed one of them, he was telling me all about this method called extensive reading. And he was super excited about it. In fact, our interview, we didn't really end up talking much about him. We just ended up talking about extensive reading. And he said he had experienced using this down when he had worked in Bangkok and in some other areas around Asia. So I got really interested in this, and I spent the next 3 months researching extensive reading. And I was like, wow, this seems like the real deal. If this is this effective, according to the research, it should really help me learn Chinese. And we'll get into my story later. But that started my whole journey into extensive reading and kind of spurred what we have today, Mandarin Companion.
Yeah, there's no language more studied in the world than English. And so it's really useful to look at what has worked well for English language learners all over the world. And extensive reading is a good example of that.
You know, I mentioned I read many different research papers, and I don't remember where I specifically ran across this, but in one of the papers, they had talked about extensive reading, and they kind of framed it in this way of fluency now. And the idea was that it was fluency now in what you know, and that extensive reading, it really helps you become fluent, and it consolidates the knowledge that you have and builds proficiency in what you know now, as opposed to fluency, you know, 5-10 years down the road when we hypothetically achieve some sort of master language status in Chinese. And that's something that really stuck with me, and I hadn't forgotten.
Okay, so how does one achieve fluency now?
Well, I think it'd be good to start out a little bit here of what is extensive reading. We've talked about this before, but this comes from a paper by Willie A. Renandia. It's called The Power of Extensive Reading, and he talks a lot about some of this research behind it, its effectiveness, and he shares some stories on, and not just stories, but research that really talks about the effectiveness of extensive reading. And so what we're going to do today is we're going to talk a little bit about this, but specifically, we are going to talk about some of the research that's from this that shows how effective it's been in different settings. But I've also collected a lot of other stories, and there's a lot of research out there on extensive reading and on how it's been impactful and super beneficial to people all around the world.
Okay, so it's extensive reading story time, but also research.
Yes, research story. Stories backed by research.
All right. Okay, now before we get into the stories, though, why don't we go over real quickly what does a successful extensive reading program look like? And this paper outlines it very nicely. So number one is that the students read a large amount of material.
Yeah, this is really important. And sometimes people think, oh yeah, extensive reading, just reading articles and stuff. But no, it's like getting a lot of input. You're reading a lot of stuff.
Yeah, they're supposed to be hooked and just like reading all the time, reading, reading, reading. Okay, number two is that students usually choose what they want to read, so they read what's interesting to them.
I'm sure we've all had that experience in school where a teacher assigned us a book we didn't want to read. How did that go? Well, this is a little different, right? Hey, choose what you want to read. Find out what's interesting to you.
Right. And number three, which kind of feeds into that, is reading materials vary in terms of topic and genre. So yeah, you can find the topic and genre you like, but you can also experience a variety of topics and genres.
Like we've tried to do with Manor Companion.
Yes, we have. Also, number four, the material students read is within their level of comprehension. So it's not too hard. It's maybe even slightly easy for them, which is a concept that a lot of people don't seem to get.
The Extensive Reading Foundation has targeted this at about like 98% comprehension of what you're reading. But, you know, it's going to vary within there. But definitely try to avoid below 90%.
Yeah, so the SLA jargon is I plus one, slightly above your current comprehensible input level. But actually, just I or I minus one, this is something you don't see often, but it's in this paper. Like something that's a little below your level is actually beneficial as well.
Sure is.
Okay, number five is that students usually take part in post-reading activities, so something to consolidate what they've read.
Yeah, I've worked with a lot of teachers on some of these things, specifically like different activities. Like you, instead of like having a traditional class, it's like you'd read, and then after reading, you'd have some sort of activity, that individual or group or small group, that are based on what you just read or the book you're reading.
And it doesn't have to be a book report.
No, it doesn't.
All right, number six is that teachers read with their students, thus modeling enthusiasm for reading. Yeah, this is something that I try to do as much as possible as a parent, but for some reason, it seems difficult to find time to read nowadays, doesn't it?
Oh, it sure can. But, you know, I will say that in regards to extensive reading, the teacher is usually a native speaker of the language, and so it's going to be a lot faster for them to read the materials than it is for the students.
Right, so teachers got a model. All right, number seven is that teachers and students keep track of student progress. So this is generally just in terms of keeping track of what books you've read, how many books, you know, the rate of completion of these books.
Yeah, but there's also a lot of other metrics that people do track. And just overall, in fact, we're going to get into this in some of the stories, but like overall words read, reading speed, and I forget, there's some other things too, but just, you know, hey, having something to track your progress can also be motivating. Say, hey, look, I'm improving.
Okay, so now what happens in individual circumstances when someone tries one of these extensive reading programs and reads a ton of books?
Well, I think let's go ahead and start out here with one of the stories. In fact, this is the author of the paper. He actually goes through and he shares his story specifically of using extensive reading to learn English. So I mentioned earlier, the author of this paper is Willy Renandia. He's from Indonesia, and he grew up in a family, and evidently not everyone was actually literate in his family. Now, he read comics and fiction in his native language and during his elementary school years, but his English proficiency was like really minimal. In fact, it barely reached the A1 level on the CEFR scale. So that's like really low, right? But despite that, he did get accepted into an English language education department in a teacher's college. And he really struggled, though, to understand lectures that were conducted entirely in English. But as his story goes, his university had a small library and had some very simplified classics. So these are kind of like some really basic graded readers. But Willy didn't really find them that interesting. But eventually, he found these Perry Mason novels. Perry Mason, it's a very popular series. You know, here in the United States, they had that long-running TV show, right, of Perry Mason.
Yeah, pretty old.
But the simple dialogues and the storylines, it just kind of captivated him. And it led him to reading about 50 Perry Mason titles. And later, he got on to Sherlock Holmes and Hercule Poirot. I never say that right. Is it Hercule? Apologies if I'm saying that wrong. So he quickly moved past graded readers, and he went on to some of this more difficult material. And it really helped him drastically improve his English proficiency. And he started out as one of the weakest students in the class, but his English skills ended up skyrocketing, and he graduated with the highest GPA in his class. His reading habits were the only explanation for his rapid progress, and that's what he gives credit to this day, is that he didn't really have any English-speaking friends at the time. He didn't travel internationally, and after graduation, he became an English teacher, and he scored exceptionally high in the TOEFL. He outperformed most of his peers, and it wasn't until his graduate studies that he learned about the works of language experts like Stephen Krashen, which has kind of spurred a lot of this stuff behind extensive reading. And he realized the power of this extensive reading movement, and he got very involved in it. So that's kind of the author's story, and he gets into some of the research here and a lot of these stories on the power of extensive reading.
Okay, so Jared, in this story, am I correct in understanding that he started with actual graded readers, but then read Perry Mason, which maybe wasn't graded readers?
Yeah, you're right. That appears accurate according to his story. So this isn't something that we would normally recommend for people, would we?
No, it's usually good to start quite simple.
That's right. That's right. I think there's a little bit of differences, and we're going to kind of cover some of this as we get into some of these stories. Mind you, most of the research done into extensive reading for language acquisition is done with people who are learning English as a second language. The nature of the language is obviously quite different than Chinese. If you come across a word you don't know in English, well, at least you can sound it out, or in French, or in German, or many other languages. But Chinese doesn't quite work that way.
Right, so that's definitely some special challenges for publishers, but the general principles of extensive reading are still the same.
That's right. And I'll make one other comment here about Willie is that motivation, you don't discount that. It just sounded like he was really motivated to read those Perry Mason novels. And I guarantee those first few novels were probably very challenging. But I'm sure by the time he got to his 10th one, he's going a lot faster. And of course, by the time he got to his 50th one, he's just breezing through it.
Yeah, actually, this issue of motivation is one that kept coming to mind for me, too, when I was reading through these stories. Obviously, reading a lot is going to help, and extensive reading is proven to be a great method. But you got to wonder, like, what is the motivation of these people? Like, it seems like it's pretty high, and it can be hard to, you know, kind of separate the motivation from the reading. But maybe they're actually quite connected, huh?
I do think so. Motivation can take you through the trough of sorrow and pain if you're reading at a very low level of comprehension and can get you through till you get to a higher level of comprehension. But a word of warning to our listeners. In my experience, for every one person who's done this, there's probably 50 to 100 who failed because they were reading things that just were too difficult. So unless you're not highly, highly motivated to read something very specific or a genre or a book or something, I'd encourage you to go towards the easier stuff first.
No, but what I was hinting at is that it's kind of a chicken and an egg thing. Like, I think that a lot of people, if they've never read something that's kind of easy but also enjoyable, and then they finally get to, then that can increase their motivation.
Oh, yeah, I agree with that. That's quite a good point.
Okay, so how about another story?
Okay, the next story we're going to talk about from his paper is about a story of a research project that was done in Fiji. Fiji, of all places. All right, so what they did is they took 9 to 11-year-old children in grades 4 or 5 and from a number of different schools. So they had a control group and a variable group. The control group was focused on just reading. They call it book floods. So the idea is that you just give them tons of books and they can read whatever they want to read during this period of time. The control group, just goes through kind of more the traditional education. So what was interesting about this is that they tracked them over a couple of years and they stayed on these types of tracks. So after the first year, the book flood group, who's just focusing on reading, they produced 15 months of reading growth over a period of 8 months, while the traditional group gained only 6.5 months of reading growth. Additionally, the reading groups, they were superior to the control group in reading and listening comprehension measures, but not on tests of English structure and writing. So, you know, I would say initially that's not that surprising. I mean, if you're going to spend a lot of time reading, obviously your reading comprehension is going to improve. That's how you improve that. And you can overall improve your reading growth, so to speak.
Right.
Now, what's interesting is that they continue to do this study, and the reading groups continue to outperform the other groups in reading, vocabulary, grammar, and writing. And what they also found is that these effects started to spread to math and other language-related skills. So they just ended up outperforming these students in the control group in just all academic measures, really. Even, I think this is like here, yeah, they even outperformed the control students in all the different subjects that were in the Fijian language, which is quite interesting. So it's like the impact that reading had was really significant.
All right, Jared, does that make sense? How is reading English helping their math?
You know what? I'm not entirely sure.
I mean, the only thing I can imagine is that it's confidence.
It might be. But I do know, if you think about this, John, and I actually should jump into some of this research, but just in L1 education, if you think about when we were growing up and even to our kids now in schools, there's so much emphasis on, hey, read, learn to read, read a book, read that type of stuff. It's because reading develops our brain in ways, I guess, that not reading doesn't.
So you're saying their brain is more plastic or something and they can accept the math more easily? That's quite a theory there, Jared.
I guess so. But what's interesting...
please continue.
But what's interesting about this project is that they ran a similar research project in Singapore that they did in Fiji. In both countries, the results of the book-based learning programs became so successful that they were adopted in the national curriculum of the countries. So, and that was back in 1991. So today they have these elements of, you know, reading programs in your second language in Fiji and Singapore because of this research that was done, gosh, that's almost 30 years ago now.
Yeah, it makes me wonder how those programs are doing today.
Maybe we should check it out. All right, the next story is from a study that was done back in 2001. So this study was brought up because it shows the ability of extensive reading to have some sort of impact and improvement despite limited quality and quantity of reading materials. So there were 60 seventh grade remedial students. So I think these are the students who aren't doing as so well in class. So they were attending a normal 40-minute English class. But in their class, they did a control group and a variable group. And the traditional group, the control group, they emphasized intensive reading and phonics. The students in the extensive reading group were provided with reading materials and were encouraged to do self-selected reading and a variety of post-reading activities. So after 6 months, the extensive reading students made more profound reading gains than the traditional group on both measures.
That's crazy. I gotta wonder, like, when I see limited quality and quantity, limited quality, like, I really wonder what were they reading? How bad were these? And yet they still seem to work?
I guess so. I would be interested to see some of these materials as well. But maybe it wasn't interesting. Maybe the leveling wasn't as good. But I think the core element behind this shows that, hey, even if it's not done well... It still has beneficial effects.
Yeah, I gotta say, when I see a graded reader that's boring, I'm not a fan. But I guess if motivation is strong enough that it can work even in that case.
And I imagine as well in this type of situation, imagine these kids are going in, they're in the remedial English class. So they probably got some teacher up there just, you know, saying, hello, my name is so-and-so. How are, you know, they're going through this really basic English or something, and all the kids are probably like, get me out of here. And so when you have the option to maybe read something that maybe you can read it, even if it isn't that interesting, well, that alternative is probably better than sitting in that class.
Or maybe it's just nice because you can read and the teacher leaves you alone, so you just have some peace and quiet.
I imagine there's a whole bunch of factors into this one, but the bottom line is that, hey, it proved to be more effective than just going through that traditional class.
All right.
Okay, John, now I'm going to jump outside of this paper because I've got 10 other stories here. We don't have time to get into all of them, but hey, there's a couple here I do want to hit on. So one comes from Japan. It's a SEG private school, and this is from a paper that was written called 7 Keys to a Successful Extensive Reading Program. It was by Akio Furukawa. So SEG is an acronym for their group. Their school is actually called Scientific Education Group. It's a private school in Tokyo, and it consists of students ranging from grades 7 to 12. Extensive reading, it's a large portion of the English education at the school, and they try to get all of their students to read 500,000 words per year. That's a lot. Actually, it's not that lot. It's not that much when you really break it down. I mean, that's going to be like 10 minutes a day type of stuff. Anyway, but students that begin reading low-level English graded readers, and then they continue to progress as they go through their education. And the goal is to get them to reading authentic English texts on the level of like Harry Potter novels. Their extensive reading program as they base it on they start with just these simple stories in class reading, then out of class reading, then the teacher advises them on books, and then they have grammar, vocabulary instruction as well, and they have opportunities to speak and write and support from parents. So, but since they began implementing an English extensive reading program in 2002, the school has consistently experienced astonishing results for their students in their English language proficiency as measured by their national test. It's called the Assessment of Communicative English Test, or ACE test. So, for example, the average score for their students in 11th grade is 729. That's out of 900. But the national average is 469. So that puts the average 11th grade student in the top 2% of all test takers in Japan. So we see these similar types of scores among all the grades for all their students and they're in the top test takers of all of Japan. And I thought was interesting about this is even the lowest scoring students score in the top 25% of all test takers in Japan. So that's significant.
Wow, it makes me wonder, is this like some kind of special school just for people who want like really awesome English?
Well, it sounds like they're definitely building that reputation. But, you know, obviously, you know these schools, John, more than I do. You've dipped your toe a lot more in Japan than I. But, you know, they're pretty serious, these schools.
Yeah, Japan is pretty intense when it comes to English. I've found that they've often been really big on intensive reading. So it's interesting to see that there's a school so big on extensive reading in Japan.
They pull out just a couple stories here. They cite one girl that she started reading graded readers in March of 2009. And then about a year and a half later, in December of 2010, she had read more than 400,000 words every month. And she ended up reading a total of like 6 million words by 2011, so it was about 2 years. And she was able to reach that level of like English proficiency without ever having lived overseas. There was another student who once again started reading these graded readers in, I think it was March 2010, they say. And then she began reading the level of Charlie and the Chocolate Factory in October 2010. So that's just, again, over about a year and a half. And during that time, read about 1.5 million words. And by the next year, she read 5.7 million words. And she'd only started learning English that year she started reading, which is pretty significant.
Wow.
So there's another super high level student here where I guess now they're super high level, but when they started out, again, just reading these graded readers. And there's one more exceptional case of a student who started reading these graded readers, level one of these graded readers in March of 2010. And by August of 2010, he had read 23 million words. This guy was probably reading like 5-6 hours
what?
A day. I know. I'm like, what on earth? Anyway, by the next year, he had finished reading The Hobbit. He'd read so many words. I don't know. It's crazy stuff. So, some of these students who got really into reading, that's not everybody's experience. We don't all have 5, 6, 10 hours a day to read. But when you do, you can see some outsized results.
Yeah, so what if everyone just made their metric for improving in a language just how many words or how many characters they could read and they stopped worrying about everything else, huh? What could be accomplished?
Oh, I think we'd see some significant progress in general language proficiency. Now, last story, this doesn't come from a research paper, but it does come from our own personal experience. This happened down at JFK Kennedy High School. JFK. This happened at JFK Kennedy High School in Iowa. It's from a teacher that we had on this podcast a few years back, Grant Brown. He was a high school teacher there at this high school, and he'd been struggling with the students to pass this AP Chinese exam. So in the United States, that's for high schoolers, they can take this exam, and if they pass it, they can get credit that goes towards university. Before graded readers and extensive reading, he really had just focused on the curriculum, the textbook. But the only ones who seemed to really pass the test were these heritage learners. Oftentimes, they had grown up in Chinese-speaking homes. But he later on discovered extensive reading and introduced it into the classroom along with textbook instruction. And he used a lot of practices, best practices for extensive reading, and he's able to take his Chinese classes from a 50% pass rate to a 100% pass rate and with an average score of 4. That's on a 5-point scale. And so that was really significant for Grant. And I've talked to a lot of teachers about his experience.
You know, I've heard this story before, but it's still impressive hearing those numbers.
Well, if you want to call it that, sure. So my story here, we'll wrap up with this. As I mentioned, I've learned about extensive reading when I was working in Shanghai, and I thought, hey, if this is as effective as it says it is, it should help me learn my Chinese. So I went out there and I found a series of Chinese graded readers. Before Manner Companion, there was Chinese Breeze. So if any of you have read those graded readers, hey, that's where I got my start. I got a bunch of those books and I ended up reading 10 graded readers in a period of about 3 months. And at the time, it took my, I just read on the subway to and fro work. And so I read maybe, 20, 30 minutes a day. Not even 30, it was about 20-ish. And my Chinese just started improving. It started just consolidating all the language in my head. I could speak a kind of real broken Chinese at that point. And within that 3 month period, my Chinese went from like broken to conversational. And all my coworkers were like, Jared, what are you doing? You know, your Chinese has improved so fast. And I'm like, I'm just reading books in Chinese. That's it. I felt like I was cheating on a test. But it was fantastic. But I read all those books, and that's what spurred me to approach John and say, hey, John, let's do this. Let's do this Manner Companion thing.
And the rest is history. But wait a minute, Jared, you are in China. So was there a period of time when you were in China but not improving, and then you started reading graded readers, and then you did improve?
Yeah, I think that's accurate. I was just kind of casually studying most of the time. There were some times where I had some more intense studying. I got one of these classic stories of like, you know, I moved to China, I didn't speak Chinese, and I got a family and work and trying to live and learn the language. It can be quite challenging putting that all together.
Right on. So some books helped you out there.
Absolutely. That was the key factor for me that really tipped the scale, if you will, on really helping me make some real progress in my Chinese.
Sadly, I do not have such a story. I went through a lot of pain and hardship to achieve literacy in Chinese, but not everyone has to go through that anymore.
You know, that goes back to something I've always said, John, is that there's a lot of ways to learn a language, and they all can work. It's just some are more effective than others. All right, now it's time for a word from our sponsor. And today our sponsor is
Mandarin Companion. Graded readers in Chinese. These are easy to read Chinese novels.
That's right. And today we're not talking about any one specific book per se. We're talking about the entire Mandarin Companion series.
So we have three levels. We originally started with level one and went on to level two, but then we went back and we added the breakthrough level, which starts at only 150 basic characters to get you reading full stories. So at the breakthrough level, we have In Search of Hua Ma, Just Friends, My Teacher is a Martian, that's a popular one, The Misadventures of Zhou Haisheng, and Xiao Ming, Boy Sherlock.
All fantastic stories. And these are original stories that are created by John and I, because we couldn't really adapt novels at that low level. It just didn't work.
Right. But once we got to level one, then that's where we have some of the famous stories adapted into a totally Chinese context in a simple Chinese story.
That's right. We have The Country of the Blind, Emma, The Monkey's Paw, The Prince and the Pauper, Sherlock Holmes and the Case of the Curly-Haired Company, The Secret Garden, and The 60-Year Dream, which is based off of Rip Van Winkle.
Don't forget about The Ransom of Red Chief.
Oh, yes. That's a fun story. Love that one.
Okay. And then at 450 characters, we have our level two. So we've got Great Expectations, Part 1 and Part 2. Those are both full-length books, but in two parts. Then there's Jekyll and Hyde, the classic with our own twist, Journey to the Center of the Earth, and Sherlock Holmes and a Scandal in China.
And we're working on a new Level 2 book right now.
We are putting a lot of love and care into this book, but it is coming.
So you can go out and you can get it today. You can check out our website, mannercompanion.com, or you can find it on Amazon, iBooks, Kobo, or wherever you get your books.
Check them out and let us know what you think.
All right, now it's time for rants and raves. John, what do you have for us today? Do you have a rant or do you have a rave?
I have a rant. I don't know, maybe it's just being grumpy, but lately I keep seeing this hype over this coffee. So it's Luckin Coffee. It's like this Chinese brand. It's been in the news a lot if you follow mm-hmm. Chinese coffee news. Luckin Coffee, and they've yep. partnered with the famous Baijiu company, Moutai. And so it's alcoholic coffee. I'm not sure how much they put in there, but you see it everywhere. And people are like, this is crazy. And lots of people are buying it, I think, for the novelty. But everyone says it's terrible. And it's just like, I don't know. I don't know why I'm ranting about this, because whatever, if people want to drink that, why do I care, right? But
he wants to drink Baijiu coffee.
Yeah, like I remember I had this friend when I lived in Hangzhou back in the early days in China, and he did extensive experiments on both Baijiu and Huangzhou, like two kinds of traditional Chinese liquor, and trying to mix them with mm-hmm. with different drinks, you know, Coke and fruit juice and like all these different things. And he came to the very definite conclusion that it doesn't mix. Like, you don't mix this alcohol with anything. You just, if you're going to drink it, you just drink it. But, you know, that wisdom is being turned on its head by Luckin Coffee. And I'm curious how long this is going to stick around, this Moutai coffee.
I did see an article on that. I'm not a drinker of coffee or alcohol, but everything I've heard about Baijiu is that it is not the best tasting.
Oh, I do not love it. So if someone ever buys it and offers me a sip, I'll try it, but I don't think I'm going to buy it. So anyway, that is my rant. How about you, Jared? You have a rant or a rave?
I got a rave today. It was a YouTube channel I ran across recently, and it was a video, and I thought it was really good, really helpful to me to understand a little bit more about some Chinese history. I am kind of a history buff. I'm a nerd in that way. But there was this video specifically called Intro to Historical Chinese Geography. And honestly, John, it was quite illuminating. It helped me understand, this is why China was largely cut off from the rest of the world. I mean, obviously we had a large land mass, but understanding how like the geography of China kind of shaped history and how history worked around the geography and even how it influenced how things are today. The YouTube channel is called Gates of Kilikain, and I'll put a link in the show notes, but for any history buffs, or even if you're interested in not even just ancient history, but even like modern Chinese history about things, like this was really instructional and I thought it was very interesting.
Does it have Chinese in it?
No, but it's a Chinese guy doing it. I'm pretty sure it's a Chinese guy. Not sure.
Okay.
But it was very interesting. It was well done, too.
Cool.
John, I'm just waiting for your witty comment about my interest in Chinese historical geography.
I got nothing, Jared. I got nothing. It's historical geography. Let's go on.
I'm Sarah Reinstein.
Sarah joined me on a sunny day from Los Angeles. We have a common friend in Nick Anderson, who she mentions in this interview a few times and was on our podcast a couple episodes ago.
And about almost a decade ago, I started working at a video game studio called Riot Games on one of my favorite video games, League of Legends, and it's been really fun.
It became quickly apparent to me that for Sarah, Chinese became a conduit into life experiences that could only be accessed by learning a new language. She has an infectious enthusiasm and zest for life that brightens your day. Stay with us. All right, Sarah, why did you start learning Chinese?
It's kind of a funny story. About 7 years ago, I had a manager at Riot who thought we could start to learn Mandarin to connect with our native Mandarin-speaking artists, either in China or in LA. And I should say that I've always thought that learning different languages was really fun. Like in high school, they made you study Spanish. In college, I studied some French. And I was like, oh, let's do it. Let's learn Mandarin. Cool. And work's going to pay for it even better.
This manager, was he Chinese or did he speak Chinese?
Yeah, he was Chinese. He did speak some Mandarin, and it was fun. It was a group class. It was him, my other coworker at the time, and he and I actually don't think spoke too much Mandarin together, actually. Mm. Like, we spoke a lot in the class. Funnily enough, he and my teammate found it hard to make time for the classes. Totally understand. Yeah. It's pretty busy at Riot. But I ended up having just an amazing time learning the language and learning from my teacher, Nick, that I was like, I would like to stick this out. And like 7 years later.
Well, you need to frame this up for me a little bit. Like, how many people were in that class? And I assume everybody was beginner. I mean, what were they doing? And how did that start out?
Yeah, actually, the classes were really interesting now that I think about it. Like, at first, it felt like a bit of a standard group class, a smaller group class. There were just three of us and Nick. And he started with, you know, PowerPoint presentations and was taking us through some really basic concepts like tones and some characters we needed to learn and how to break down the characters. But then the classes sort of changed into a rare opportunity of like a one-on-one session. When my manager and my teammate dropped out, it was just me and him.
Oh.
And that was awesome. I think that's also probably what like helped my Mandarin stick really well, was that we were just doing very curated sessions for me and my learning. We were meeting about twice a week for an hour, but probably for a solid 4 to 5 years, it was me and Nick for about 2 hours a week. He left Riot a few years ago, and I think towards the end, we were doing about one class a week.
So it sounds like the company was saying, okay, cool. You want to study Mandarin? Here, we got you a teacher, mm-hmm. which turned into a personal tutor. Right?
Yeah.
And 2 hours a week. So not a bad gig. Why did you stick with it, though? I'm sure you have a lot of other hobbies and interests. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of things to do, business. You know, so your work is really busy. But what was it that kind of kept you saying, hey, I want to really learn this. I'm going to keep going.
Aside from, I guess, the unexplainable why we like things and we don't like other things, I think with Mandarin in particular, learning Chinese, it created all these very like super exciting and unique and fun and different opportunities in my life that I like either couldn't get enough of, or I was just super excited to see what the next thing would be, the next application, the next conversation with somebody. And like, I also got to learn so much about other people that have had a really different life than growing up in South Florida. I think like a year or two into the language is when like moment where I was like, I'm going to stick this out. I'm going to keep with this language for the rest of my life. And I think that's still true. Nick and I went to China for a couple of weeks.
Oh, nice.
It was so fun. It was a big risk. For him, probably, because we had been studying together, but, you know, we were going to go to China for 2 weeks, travel the world for the first time. And he took me to all these, like, very Chinese places, like, not a lot of American tourists or really, like, foreigners. Nice. And I would say at the time, I was pretty nervous to speak with folks, but I was doing a lot of listening. And the conversations that Nick would have with people or like connect with people, like, oh my God, we would get like massages every other day. And the conversations that they would have were just super funny and fun. Or like just around LA, like I remember having a conversation with a restaurant owner and it like made me laugh so hard. And all it was him teasing me that I should speak Mandarin with him more. It's like all these different conversations, either with coworkers or strangers out in the world. And I think also a lot of people at work were so encouraging. Mm. Like that was a huge part of why I stuck with it too, is because I would like say three things, probably poorly, and they would be like, oh my God, that's amazing. Keep going. You got this. And so I was like, oh, great. I believe you. I'm going to stick with it.
Yeah, that's definitely a great thing about Chinese is that, and I assume these are Chinese coworkers you're referring to.
Yeah, I have native Chinese speaking coworkers and people from China. There's also a couple folks at Riot who are from North America who were also super encouraging and they also speak Mandarin.
Oh, really? So these are native English speakers who learned Mandarin.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, well, that's great.
I'm not sure why they did. It'd be fun to ask them.
Yeah, I should find their story now. So
yeah.
It sounds like you had a lot of real positive experiences and just memorable things. Is there any of those experiences that really stick out to you that were more meaningful or really impactful upon you?
I feel like I've been studying Mandarin for about like 6 or 7 years, so my memory is not too great. But let's see, one time, this was really fun. I had the opportunity to speak Mandarin with Jay Cho for work.
Jay Cho, I'm not familiar with him. You have to forgive me.
Oh, okay. So Jay Cho is a very famous Taiwanese singer-songwriter.
Oh, okay. I think I know who you're talking about now. Okay.
Yeah.
So tell us about this. Wow.
Yeah. So I have like a crush on Jay Cho. I find him like really cool and he's handsome. He's very talented. And yeah, this is like just random opportunity because I'd been studying Mandarin for a few years. He was coming on site onto Riot's campus. This was a couple of years ago. One of our games was having a celebration. I think it was Wild Rift. And I think one of the teams heard that I, you know, had this big old crush on him and that I could speak some Mandarin. Uh-huh. And so they were like, would you like to be kind of like marketing materials? Like it wasn't YouTube, but like a video for these skins that we were making for League of Legends. I was like, okay, yeah, sign me up. I'm not sheepish. Like, I will do my best to have the best tones, but like, I'm not going to miss this opportunity to speak Mandarin with Jay Cho. So he came on campus with like his crew, which was just super, it was so exciting. And he was speaking mostly Mandarin the whole time, but his crew members were like sometimes going in and out of English. We were sitting in the PC cafe. This is like very fond memory, sitting in the PC cafe at work, and me and like one of his coworkers or his entourage. It was supposedly like one of his good friends. We were playing the game and we were speaking Mandarin with one another, and he was like, "What? Why do you speak?" Because that's always the question. Telling him it's just really fun and like learning for work. And he joked that I would be his English teacher and he would be my Chinese teacher. Like, oh, this is so cool. So fun. And I got to tell Jay Cho what my favorite song was of his in Mandarin. And then they asked if I would sing it. And I was like, no. No way.
Sing the song in front of the actual songwriter and performer.
Yeah, exactly. Right? Like, no, that's okay. I also can't sing. So, but that was so cool. We got to tell him. Me and another coworker at the time, who he's also American, and he was studying Mandarin. So the two of us were explaining to Jay Cho where the background of these skins came from, which was really cool.
Wow. That sounds really neat. So you got some, I guess, FaceTime, if you will, with him. You got to actually talk directly to him. That's a great experience. I'm assuming you got some pictures, did you not?
We did. We did take pictures. You say that, and I'm like, where are those pictures? I should print them out and put them on my wall, because it was like, it was so cool.
You could plaster your wall like, you know, like a 14-year-old girl, right? You know, favorite band. There you go. That's awesome. Wow.
It was so cool.
That's amazing. I mean, I imagine you may have been able to interact with them at some point, you know, if you didn't speak Mandarin, but it's like Mandarin definitely opened that door.
It probably would have been English speaking the whole time. And I don't think I would have been able to like joke with them and learn a little bit about them and what they were excited about, where they were going in LA. And with translators, or one thing I learned learning Mandarin was I would watch something that's like in Chinese and the English translation at the bottom. I'm like, oh, that's not exactly what they said. That's kind of close to what they said. Or like an idiom might not translate well. So it was like, I knew what I was meaning to say was going to get to them.
Wow, that's really neat.
I respond really well to positive reinforcement. And so whenever friends and family are like impressed or they're excited, it makes me want to stick it out even more. And so my sister, she lives out in DC. I went to visit her and she's like, oh, we have to go to this really amazing Chinese restaurant. You're going to love it. And I think I had gotten back from China and probably talked a lot about all like, Nick and I only ate Chinese food there. Nick told me they didn't have any other restaurants other than Chinese restaurants, which is not true.
Not entirely accurate, but hey, you're still eating good out of there.
We ate so well. But we sat down and it, you know, looked like everybody there was native Mandarin speakers and like they're speaking Mandarin to one another. And it felt very like piece of China back in North America. But the owner of the restaurant came over and I just wanted a glass of water. My mom always gets really tickled when I speak Mandarin and she gets to see it live. So I asked the owner, like, oh, can I have a glass of water? And I kept it really short, you know, because I was a little nervous. And he looked at me and very confused. But then, like, it was like a shift. Like, instantly, he just joked and he was like, it's really expensive. Or, like, that was the immediate response. Like, it's expensive. Was taken aback, like, wait a minute. And then I like, oh, this is in Mandarin. I asked him, like, really? And, like, we both just, like, started laughing. And so, like, he walked away to go get water while I was, like, I was laughing so hard. And I had to explain to my mom, like,
Your mom's like, what did he say? What happened? Right.
Yeah, exactly that. And I was like, Mom, I just got trolled. Like, just got super joked with. So he was super nice. He came back over and he was like, asked why I was studying. And he was super nice. He was like, oh, your Mandarin is so good. And I'm like, like, it's good that you can understand.
It's one of those things, like, your mom comes away from those experiences and be like, my daughter speaks fluent Chinese, right? And you're like, oh, it's maybe not as fluent as you think it is, Mom.
Yes. I'm like, please don't tell anybody that. You can tell them, like, I'm barely conversational. I didn't say I'm conversational, but yeah, don't tell anyone I'm fluent.
But it was good enough to share a joke with the restaurant owner.
Oh, yeah. I think making Chinese people laugh is, like, one of the funniest things. It's so great. I don't know why, but I'm like, I love cracking them up.
Oh, that's good. That's good. You know, I got to admit, I'd enjoy that as well. Sometimes it's that sarcasm, you know? Sometimes it seems to me not as prevalent in Chinese culture, but it's there. That's sometimes my source of humor, you know? Mm-hmm. And when they get it, they're like, oh, right, good stuff.
Oh, my gosh. Oh, God. This was so funny and so embarrassing.
You'll get all these embarrassing stories, man. These are the best.
This one's really good. So one time, Nick and I were traveling in Hangzhou. And a little bit of background, Nick is from, oh, don't kill me, Nick, like, Illinois, Indiana. He's from North America. He's white. He's blonde. He's blue-eyed. And we get to Hangzhou. We get to the hotel. And leading up to there, quite a few people, understandably but mistakenly, thought that we were together, starting with, like, the person who checks your passport. It's like, you two are together, right? And we're like, no. And so, like, everybody we met thought we were, like, Zhang Fu and Tai Tai. Mm-hmm. Like, we were husband and wife.
Sure, whatever.
Yeah. Like, one time we were at a store, like, literally just, like, a storefront looking at stuff. And we'd heard it so many times. Nick turns to me and he's like, oh, Tai Tai, or, like, girlfriend or something. Mm-hmm. And I looked up to him and this was in Mandarin. And I was like, I'm not your girlfriend. And the store owner overheard everything and just, like, lost it. Like, he thought it was the funniest thing. It was so funny. Like, I mean, all he sees is two people, like, going, yeah, you're my girlfriend. I'm not your girlfriend.
This is a little awkward.
Yeah.
A little confusing.
Yeah. I think he was probably confused, but it was really funny.
Oh.
But when we were in Hangzhou, we were checking into the hotel and Nick told them that we were on our honeymoon.
Oh. Wow. Okay.
Yeah, really leaning into the joke at this point. I think because they were asking us if we wanted one bed or two beds. We were like, yeah, well, we want two beds. But then Nick joked that we were on our honeymoon and we, like, we check into a room, we sit down, and, like, maybe, like, 15 minutes later, the people at the front desk knock on our door and they had brought us a bottle of wine to celebrate our honeymoon. Because they were like, we're so honored that you chose our hotel to spend your honeymoon at. I was like, oh my God, it's gone too far. we're lying now.
It's like going to the restaurant, it's my birthday, and they bring out, like, a slice of cake, right?
Oh, yeah, it was exactly, yeah, like that. Yeah. I felt so guilty, but, you know, they wanted to take a picture with us. It was so sweet.
And it's still on the wall there to this day, I'm sure.
I would love to go back to Hangzhou. Like, what if they put our picture up? I would just keep up the farce.
You got to roll with it. At that point, you don't want to disappoint them. So.
Exactly.
Well, Sarah, I'm curious to know as well, like, what are some of the things, like, along your Chinese learning journey, did you have any, like, breakthrough periods or times or experiences where you felt like Chinese really kind of came together and you were like, oh, wow, you know, I did that, or now it makes sense?
There were moments where it was kind of something that kind of slowly built up. And before I realized it, things were already starting to click. Like, I recall, not the specific class, but I do recall a class where at the end of class, Nick was like, hey, did you realize, like, we only spoke Mandarin the whole time?
Hmm.
Like, we didn't have to go into English. Oh, no. That's crazy. I want to say that was probably like a couple years into studying. But I think since that moment, things started to pick up a little bit quicker. That was definitely like a pivotal moment in learning. Because then all of a sudden, like, we didn't ever really need to use English unless we were learning a new word. And then at some point, it was like explaining a new word. You could actually sometimes even explain it with Mandarin.
That makes a lot of sense. I know what you mean. It's like, well, wait a second. I did that. That did happen. That's a milestone for sure.
Yeah. And I feel like I could have helped them better today than I did then. But there was like a couple standing, like they're on like a street corner in LA. And I was like, it kind of looks like they're lost, and didn't want to assume, but it's like, I think they're speaking Mandarin. So I kind of went up and asked them, like, do you need help? Or hi, like, where are you trying to go? And it was a little bit more challenging than it would be today. But I was able to understand they were trying to get to Beverly Hills. And I was like, oh, okay. Like, because, like, it's that way. Like, it kind of.
Yeah, exactly. Walk straight. Don't stop.
They were pretty far from it. So I was like, okay. And I think I tried to help them in their app. It's like moments like that, or like, I remember also taking Ubers. If the GPS was in Mandarin, I was like, oh, so yo, like, oh, cool, cool. Like, I hear it. Like, it's starting to, like, I'm starting to hear it and recognize it and understand it in a lot of other places than just class.
Well, that makes sense. And I'm curious to know, though, what else were you doing to learn Chinese? Because I know you're doing, you said, class twice a week, roughly, and then later on went, I think, even to once a week. Mm-hmm. But, you know, to really make progress in your Mandarin learning, it's going to take more than that. And so tell me, what were you doing as well to kind of supplement your out-of-class learning?
This is probably, I think, what helped me the most is I've been described by my friend as having, like, a shameless approach to learning Mandarin. So I really tried to speak Mandarin as much as possible with whoever would speak with me.
That's great.
Yeah. And it did lead to some very, like, silly experiences. Like, tried to ask one coworker, like, what did you do last weekend? Very easy to say, did you do it last weekend? And it was just a little, he was like, oh, you shouldn't ask me that.
It's a little overt.
Exactly. I remember having a lot of conversations with folks was something that helped a lot with conversation and comprehension. We actually used the companion readers.
Mandarin companion. Ding, ding, ding.
Mm-hmm. And then Nick kind of introduced different tools that I could use outside of class. Like, there's like different apps that we used. Sometimes I would turn on Chinese subtitles on Netflix. That's pretty hard, especially because, like, the speed at which they come. Mm-hmm. We tried to take an approach of, like, having a lot of Mandarin just, like, exposed to you and being surrounded by it and, like, taking what you can, letting the rest go, not being super attached to, like, oh, I didn't understand exactly, like, every word that was said in that sentence. But being okay with that, even if you got one or two words, you just move on to the next one, and then maybe you'd get three words in the next sentence. So for me personally, it was really fun to find as many different ways, like reading, listening, conversation, you know, weird opportunities at work that would inspire me to practice more so that I can tell Jay Cho, oh, my favorite song is Qinghuazi.
So I'm curious to know, do you currently have any Chinese language goals right now?
I had such an amazing time in China with Nick, and that was in 2018. And, you know, it's been 5 years, and I think my Mandarin is in a much different space than it was then. And I'd say there's still a dream inside of me that I can go back to China with Nick and just be even more engaged in the trip and maybe pick specific places. I have completely different hobbies than I did back then too. So, like, probably try to take Nick to, like, the mountains of China so we can go rock climbing. So for right now, I'm in a little bit of, like, maintenance mode. with Mandarin, like, to me, that means like I'm trying to maintain what I have, trying to read a little bit. Nick goes like, try to do 10 minutes a day. And then, you know, Nick and I have a project that we want to work on. So I think like practicing some Mandarin so that he and I can have conversations again. I feel the drive to start leaning in hard again.
You want to make it back over.
Oh, yeah.
Have another experience.
I would love to. Or like, I'd love to go to Taiwan too. I know that's, or Singapore. Like, I used to travel to China for work as well. And that was really fun to speak a little bit of Mandarin with the folks we work with over there, or listen in on their like skins reviews and be like, oh, this is so cool.
That's great. You know, like, I was thinking there's always new horizons to pursue, right? I've met some very high level Mandarin speakers, and they always have something, you know, usually have something, you know, what's next for them. You know, they're working and want to read this book or do this or do go there, you know?
That totally makes sense. I think naturally, like, what draws me are like these fun experiences. And sometimes I don't always think about like, oh, like having a business mastery level would be very cool. Like to be able to just speak about like this new project I'm on at work. We may work with folks over in Shanghai. I don't know. We may work with folks that are native Mandarin speakers again. And so that would be really cool to speak about more technical terms. Or like, there's actually a new show coming out soon, The Three Body Problem, or Santi.
Great book. Read it in English, not Chinese.
Yeah.
Yes, but it's a fantastic book. Yeah, really good.
Yeah, so good. Read it in English as well. And I'm excited for the show. And I'm like, oh man, watching the show in Mandarin would be really cool.
So. Yeah, definitely. No, that's great. Well, you know, I think it's really neat to hear all this from you, Sarah, because it's like what I kind of hear from you is that, you know, you really treasure and value those experiences that Chinese has brought to you. Maybe with career and work, it's kind of almost a side benefit from what I'm hearing from you. It's like, hey, I like experiencing new things, connecting with people and living life. And Chinese is maybe a way to help expand that.
Yeah, that totally makes sense. That resonates. The connecting with people part, like I feel like with the people at work, and I'm sure that's helped me in other ways. I'm sure it's been very valuable and useful in ways that I haven't felt or haven't really paid attention to, because the things that are like overpowering those opportunities or those like maybe career progression is really just like connecting with my native Mandarin speaking coworkers and also fellow white people who are like, we're going to try this really hard thing. So we have these like shared experiences with that group, and then positive reinforcement from another group of like, oh, thank you so much for like trying to learn this language and having conversations. So the connecting with people part has been my favorite.
So I would like to hear from you. Like, if Sarah, if you could go back and give some advice to Sarah from, I guess, 7-8 years ago when you first started learning Chinese, what would you tell yourself and what would you do differently, if anything?
I'd probably tell myself to study more, to read more. I think that reading, this might be unique to every learner, but I think it's always felt like the most challenging. So you're not having a conversation with somebody else. You could maybe, if you think about reading as that, but you're not having a conversation with somebody else. It's very quiet. It's very focused. It's like probably the most disciplined, maybe outside of writing characters, but it always is the most beneficial. It's like return on investment. Reading is the best. Like, I didn't recognize that until a few years in. And so even just like a couple minutes a day, just like a page, I started to notice like it was really helpful in like speaking and comprehension. So I'd say like trying to incorporate a little bit more discipline. It might have like speed boosted me a little bit more.
And what advice would you give to just anyone who's just started learning Chinese or even thinking about it?
This could change your life. Like, there will be moments in work and with people that you meet that because you can speak their language or some amount of like shared different language, like it's going to result in something you wouldn't have thought possible, which is pretty broad.
Well, on that note, Sarah, how has Chinese changed your life?
It's given me like borderline too much confidence in myself. I say that because it, I feel like, has unlocked in me is that this feeling of like, I can do anything. Growing up in Florida or growing up in North America, there is a perception that learning Mandarin. Like a lot of people, a lot of my friends that are from the United States are like, wow, that's so hard. I can't believe it. Or like, wow, isn't that really hard? Isn't that hard? I'm like, yeah, but like, it's possible to do hard things.
Yeah, yeah.
This language is totally, like, you can master this in the same way that you've probably mastered, like, 5 to 10 to, like, I don't know, plus 10 other things in your life. It's just like anything else. It's not magic. It's a learnable language. Just spending some time getting to a point where, like, I could have a conversation with somebody, I was like, whoa, this is totally possible. Other people should know that this is possible. And it's given me a lot of confidence in myself to go do other things that, like, seem hard.
Like what?
It's kind of funny, but, like, about 4 years ago, I started rock climbing.
Yeah.
And, like, it's pretty difficult. There's certain disciplines in climbing that are incredibly technical, very hard, either physically or not needing physical strength, but needing like a certain amount of discipline, a certain amount of learning, potentially like getting into the right headset. It's similar in that like there's a lot of people that are like, well, isn't rock climbing really hard? Or isn't that style of climbing really hard? And I'm like, it is, but I don't know, you're like kind of learned to climb in just a couple of years. Mm-hmm. Like that's, it's masterable.
Yeah, I like how you're saying, you know, is it hard? Well, yeah, but you can still do it.
Yeah.
You know, sometimes getting out of bed is hard, but you know, you can do that too. So
I would probably apply this to a lot of other areas, but I think it's important not to treat it like it's impossible.
Usually when people say, you know, oh man, that's a really hard language, I says, it has its challenges.
That's true. It definitely does.
But so does English.
That's, yeah.
So does every language. But yeah, yet we can do it. Well, Sarah, then what advice would you give to someone who's starting to learn Chinese right now or even thinking about it?
Ooh, I'd give at least two pieces of advice. One is find a teacher that believes in you, that you connect with, that you feel safe with. I think that was just super important in my journey. And that's what made me stick it out, was my connection with my teacher. And the second would be, there's so many different tools out there now for learning Mandarin, like books, YouTube, online tutors, Discord channels, group sessions. I think there's like pen pal situations where you can have conversations. So don't be like overwhelmed or dissuaded from continuing studying if like one of those tools doesn't work for you. I think we're all very different learners. So you have to find like what gets you excited, even if that's, you know, like, okay, you force yourself to read 10 minutes a day. I'd hammer in this advice is like to be shameless. Is that like, it's going to feel weird. It's going to feel scary. It is scary to speak Mandarin with anyone at first, like even now, it's like 7 or 8 years in and I still get a little nervous and jittery to like, oh, okay, I'm gonna do it. But like, you have to get over that emotion and you can't be worried that like someone else is gonna think like, oh, they said that thing wrong or they sound silly. Like no one's gonna think that. No one is ever gonna punish you or tell you that you sound dumb because you're trying to speak another language.
Yeah, you're right. And especially in Chinese, those native speakers are usually very forgiving. They're, if you do.
Yes, super forgiving.
Wow, that's really great. Well, thanks so much for taking this time to share your story with us. And I just really enjoyed hearing about your zest for Chinese and life. And it sounds like it's just been a wonderful road and journey for you.
Yeah, it has been. Thanks so much for asking me to and for listening.
It's been my pleasure.
You have been listening to the You Can Learn Chinese podcast. Help us spread the word by sharing this with your friends, classmates, teachers, cousins, agent, beachcomber, bus driver, mixologist, coach, therapist, and that one gal named Danielle. Please subscribe to our podcast, share it with a friend, and if you enjoyed this episode, leave us a review. You can also reach out to us at mannercompanion.com or mannercompanion on social media. Apologies to John Cena, we just ran out of time. The You Can Learn Chinese podcast is produced by myself, Jared Turner, and our editor is Kaiser Guo. I'd like to thank our special guest, Sarah Reinstein. And of course, thanks to my co-host, the man, the myth, the legend, John Paston. See you next time.